$100 a month, perhaps taking a young Balinese man or woman as a companion, where they can drink before noon without getting any static about it, where they can make a bit of money exporting a bit of furniture for somebody. But generally, all they are doing here is seeing to it that nothing serious will ever be asked of them again. These are not bums, mind you. This is a very high grade of people, multinational, talented, and clever. But it seems to me that everyone I meet here used to be something once, generally married or employed, and now they are all united by the absence of the one thing they seem to have surrendered completely and forever, ambition. Needless to say, there's a lot of drinking. Of course, the precious Balinese town of Ubud is not such a bad place to putter away your life, ignoring the passing of the days. I suppose in that way, it's similar to places like Key West, Florida, or Oaxaca, Mexico. Most expats in Ubud, when you ask them how long they've lived here, aren't really sure. For one thing, they aren't really sure how much time has passed since they moved to Bali. But for another thing, it's like they aren't really sure if they do live here. They belong to nowhere, unanchored. Some of them like to imagine that they're just hanging out for a while, just running the engine on idle at the traffic light, waiting for the signal to change. But after 17 years of that, you start to wonder, does anybody ever leave? There is much to enjoy in their lazy company in these long Sunday afternoons spent at brunch drinking champagne and talking about nothing. Still, when I am around this scene, I feel somewhat like Dorothy in the poppy fields of Oz. Be careful. Don't fall asleep in this narcotic meadow, or you could doze away the rest of your life here. So what will become of me and Felipe, now that there is, it seems, a me and Felipe? He told me not long ago, "Sometimes I wish you were a lost little girl, and I could scoop you up and say, 'Come and live with me now. Let me take care of you forever.' But you aren't a lost little girl. You're a woman with a career, with ambition. You're a perfect snail. You carry your home on your back. You should hold on to that freedom for as long as possible. But all I'm saying is this. If you want this Brazilian man, you can have him. I'm yours already." I'm not sure what I want. I do know that there's a part of me which has always wanted to hear a man say, "Let me take care of you forever," and I have never heard it spoken before. Over the last few years, I'd given up looking for that person, learned how to say this heartening sentence to myself, especially in times of fear. But to hear it from someone else now, from someone who is speaking sincerely. I was thinking about all this last night, after Felipe fell asleep and I was curled up beside him, wondering what would become of us. What are the possible futures? What about the geography question between us? Where would we live? Then there's the age difference to consider. Though, when I called my mother the other day to tell her I'd met a really nice man, but brace yourself, Mom, he's 52 years old, she was completely nonflummoxed. All she said was, "Well, I got news for you, Liz. You're 35. Excellent point, Ma. I'm lucky to get anyone at such a withered age. Truthfully, though, I don't really mind the age difference either. I actually like that Felipe is so much older. I think it's sexy. It makes me feel kind of French. What will happen with us? Why am I worrying about this, by the way? What have I not yet learned about the futility of worry? So, after a while, I stopped thinking about all this and just held him while he slept. I am falling in love with this man. Then I fell asleep beside him and had two memorable dreams. Both were about my guru. In the first dream, my guru informed me that she was closing down her ashrams and that she would no longer be speaking, teaching, or publishing books. She gave her students one final speech in which she said, "You've had more than enough teachings. You have been given everything you need to know in order to be free. It's time for you to go out in the world and live a happy life." The second dream was even more confirming. I was eating in a terrific restaurant in New York City with Felipe. We were having a wonderful meal of lamb chops and artichokes and fine wine, and we were talking and laughing happily. I looked across the room and saw Swamiji, my guru's master, deceased since 1982. But he was alive that night, right there in a snazzy New York restaurant. He was eating dinner with a group of his friends, and they also seemed to be having a merry time of it. Our eyes met across the room, And Swamiji smiled at me and raised his wine glass in a toast. And then, quite distinctly, this small Indian guru, who had spoken precious little English during his lifetime, mouthed this one word to me across the distance. Enjoy. 105. I haven't seen Coutelier in so long. Between my involvement with Felipe and my struggle to secure a home for Wyan, my long afternoons of aimless conversation about spirituality on the medicine man's porch have long since ended. I've stopped by his house a few times just to say hello and to drop off a gift of fruit for his wife, but we haven't spent any quality time together since back in June. Whenever I try to apologize to Kutut for my absence, though, he laughs like a man who has already been shown the answers to every test in the universe and says, "Everything working perfect, Liz." Still, I miss the old man, so I stopped by to hang out with him this morning. He beamed at me, as usual, saying, "I'm very happy to meet you." I was never able to break him of that habit. "I am happy to see you, too, Kutut." "You leaving soon, Liz?" "Yes, Kutut, in less than 2 weeks. That's why I wanted to come over today. I wanted to thank you for everything you've given me. If it wasn't for you, I never would have come back to Bali." "Always you were coming back to Bali," he said without doubt or drama. "You still meditate with your four brothers like I teach you?" "Yes." "You still meditate like your guru in India teach you?" "Yes." "You have bad dreams anymore?" "No." "You happy now with God?" "Very." "You love new boyfriend?" "I think so. Yes." "Then you must spoil him, and he must spoil you." "Okay," I promised. "You are good friend to me, better than friend. You are like my daughter," he said. "When I die, you will come back to Bali, come to my cremation. Balinese cremation ceremony, very fun, you will like it." "Okay," I promised again, all choked up now. "Let your conscience be your guide. If you have Western friends come to visit Bali, bring them to me for palm reading. I'm very empty in my bank since the bomb. You want to come with me to baby ceremony today?" And this is how I ended up participating in the blessing of a baby who had just reached the age of 6 months and who was now ready to touch the earth for the first time. The Balinese don't let their children touch the ground for the first 6 months of life, because newborn babies are considered to be gods sent straight from heaven, and you wouldn't let a god crawl around on the floor with all the toenail clippings and cigarette butts. So Balinese babies are carried for those first 6 months, revered as minor deities. If a baby dies before it is 6 months old, it is given a special cremation ceremony, and the ashes are not placed in a human cemetery, because this being was never human, it was only ever a god. But if the baby lives to 6 months, then a big ceremony is held, and the child's feet are allowed to touch the earth at last, and Junior is welcomed to the human race. This ceremony today was held at the house of one of Kutut's neighbors. The baby in question was a girl, already nicknamed Putu. Her parents were a beautiful teenage girl and an equally beautiful teenage boy, who is the grandson of a man who is Kutut's cousin or something like that. Kutut wore his finest clothes for the event, a white satin sarong trimmed in gold, and a white, long-sleeved, button-down jacket with gold buttons and a Nehru collar, which made him look rather like a railroad porter or a busboy at a fancy hotel. He had a white turban wrapped around his head. His hands, as he proudly showed me, were all pimped out with giant gold rings and magic stones, about 7 rings in total, all of them with holy powers. He had his grandfather's shining brass bell for summoning spirits, and he wanted me to take a lot of photographs of him. We walked over to his neighbor's compound together. It was a considerable distance, and we had to walk on the busy main road for a while. I'd been in Bali almost 4 months, and had never seen Kutut leave his compound before. It was disconcerting, watching him walk down the highway amid all the speeding cars and madcap motorcycles. He looked so tiny and vulnerable. He looked so wrong, set against this modern backdrop of traffic and honking horns. It made me want to cry for some reason, but I was feeling a little extra emotive today anyway. About 40 guests were there already at the neighbor's house when we arrived, and the family altar was heaped with offerings, piles of woven palm baskets filled with rice, flowers, incense, roasted pigs, some dead geese and chickens, coconut and bits of currency that fluttered around in the breeze. Everybody was decked out in their most elegant silks and lace. I was underdressed, sweaty from my bike ride, self-conscious in my broken T-shirt amid all this beauty. But I was welcomed exactly the way you would want to be welcomed if you were the white girl who'd wandered in inappropriately attired and uninvited. Everyone smiled at me with warmth, then ignored me, and commenced the part of the party where they all sat around admiring each other's clothes. The ceremony took hours, Katut officiating. Only an anthropologist with a team of interpreters could tell you all that occurred, but some of the rituals I understood from Katut's explanations and from books that I had read. The father held the baby during the first round of blessings, and the mother held an effigy of the baby, a coconut swaddled to look like an infant. This coconut was blessed and doused with holy water, just like the real baby, then placed on the ground right before the baby's feet touch earth for the first time. This is to fool the demons, who will attack the dummy baby and leave the real baby alone. There were hours of chants, though, before that real baby's feet could touch ground. Katut rang his bell and sang his mantras endlessly, and the young parents beamed with pleasure and pride. The guests came and went, milling about, gossiping, watching the ceremony for a while, offering their gifts, and then taking off for another appointment. It was all strangely casual amid the ancient ritualistic formality, sort of backyard picnic meets high church. The mantras Katut chanted to the baby were so sweet, sounding like a combination of the sacred and the affectionate. While the mother held the infant, Katut waved before the child samples of food, fruit, flowers, water, bells, a wing from the roast chicken, a bit of pork, a cracked coconut. With each new item, he would sing something to her. The baby would laugh and clap her hands, and Katut would laugh and keep singing. I imagined my own translation of his words. Oh, little baby, this is roast chicken for you to eat. Someday you will love roast chicken, and we hope you have lots of it. Oh, little baby, this is a chunk of cooked rice. May you always have all the chunks of cooked rice you could ever desire. May you be showered with rice for always. Oh, little baby, this is a coconut. Isn't it funny how this coconut looks? Someday you will eat lots of coconuts. Oh, little baby, this is your family. Do you not see how much your family adores you? Oh, little baby, you are precious to the whole universe. You are an A-plus student. You are our magnificent bunny. You are a yummy hunk of silly putty. Oh, little baby, you are the sultan of swing. You are our everything. Everyone was blessed again and again with flower petals dipped in holy water. The whole family took turns passing the baby around, cooing to her, while Katut sang the ancient mantras. They even let me hold the baby for a while, even in my jeans, and I whispered my own blessings to her as everyone else sang. Good luck, I told her. Be brave. It was boiling hot, even in the shade. The young mother, dressed in a sexy bustier under her sheer lace shirt, was sweating. The young father, who didn't seem to know any facial expression other than a massively proud grin, was also sweating. The various grandmothers fanned themselves, got weary, sat down, stood up, fussed with the roasted sacrificial pigs, chased away dogs. Everybody was alternately interested, not interested, tired, laughing, earnest. But Katut and the baby seemed to be locked in their own experience together, riveted to each other's attention. The baby didn't take her eyes off the old medicine man all day. Whoever heard of a 6-month-old baby not crying or fussing or sleeping for 4 straight hours in the hot sun, but just watching someone with curiosity? Katut did his job well, and the baby did her job well, too. She was fully present for her transformation ceremony from God status to human status. She was handling the responsibilities marvelously, like a good Balinese girl already, steeped in ritual, confident of her beliefs, obedient to the requirements of her culture. At the end of all the chanting, the baby was wrapped in a long, clean white sheet that hung far below her little legs, making her look tall and regal, a veritable debutante. Catoot made a drawing on the bottom of a pottery bowl of the four directions of the universe, filled the bowl with holy water, and set it on the ground. This hand-drawn compass marked the holy spot on earth where the baby's feet would first touch. Then the whole family gathered by the baby, everyone seeming to hold her at the same time, and whoop, there goes. They lightly dipped the baby's feet in this pottery bowl full of holy water, right above the magic drawing which encompassed the whole universe, and then they touched her souls to the earth for the first time. When they lifted her back into the air, tiny damp footprints remained on the ground below her, orienting this child at last onto the great Balinese grid, establishing who she was by establishing where she was. Everyone clapped their hands, delighted. The little girl was one of us now, a human being, with all the risks and thrills which that perplexing incarnation entails. The baby looked up, looked around, smiled. She wasn't a god anymore. She didn't seem to mind. She wasn't fearful at all. She seemed thoroughly satisfied with every decision she had ever made. 106. The deal fell through with Wyann. That property Felipe had found for her somehow didn't happen. When I ask Wyann what went wrong, I get some fuzzy reply about a lost deed. I don't think I was ever told the real story. What matters is only that it's a dead deal. I'm starting to get kind of panicked about this whole Wyann house situation. I try to explain my urgency to her, saying, Wyann, I have to leave Bali in less than 2 weeks and go back to America. I can't face my friends who gave me all this money and tell them that you still don't have a home. But, Lise, if a place has no good taksu... Everybody has a different sense of urgency in this life. But a few days later, Wyann calls over at Felipe's house, giddy. She's found a different piece of land, and this one she really loves, an emerald expanse of rice field on a quiet road close to town. It has good taksu written all over it. Wyann tells us that the land belongs to a farmer, a friend of her father's, who is desperate for cash. He has 7 aro total to sell, but, needing fast money, would be willing to give her just the 2 aro she can afford. She loves this land. I love this land. Felipe loves this land. Tutti, spinning across the grass in circles, arms extended like a little Balinese Julie Andrews, loves it too. Buy it, I tell Wyann. But a few days pass, and she keeps stalling. Do you want to live there or not? I keep asking. She stalls some more, then changes her story again. This morning, she says, the farmer called to tell her that he isn't certain anymore whether he can sell only the 2 aro parcel to her. Instead, he might want to sell the whole 7 aro lot intact. It's his wife that's the problem. The farmer needs to talk to his wife to see if it's okay with her to break up the land. Wyann says, maybe if I have more money. Dear God, she wants me to come up with the cash to buy the whole chunk of land. Even as I'm trying to figure out how to raise a staggering 22,000 extra American dollars, I'm telling her, Wyann, I can't do it. I don't have the money. Can't you make a deal with the farmer? Then Wyann, whose eyes are not exactly meeting mine anymore, crochets a complicated story. She tells me that she visited a mystic the other day, and the mystic went into a trance and said that Wyann absolutely needs to buy this entire 7 aro package in order to make a good healing center, that this is destiny. And anyway, the mystic also said that if Wyann could have the entire package of land, then maybe she could someday build a nice fancy hotel there. A nice fancy hotel? That's when suddenly I go deaf and the birds stop singing and I can see Wyann's mouth moving, but I'm not listening to her anymore because a thought has just come, scrawled blatantly across my mind. She's fucking with you, groceries. I stand up, say goodbye to Wyann, walk home slowly, and ask Felipe point blank for his opinion. Is she fucking with me? He has not ever commented upon my business with Wyann, not once. Darling, he says kindly, of course she's fucking with you. My heart drops into my guts with a splat. But not intentionally, he adds quickly. You need to understand the thinking in Bali. It's a way of life here for people to try to get the most money they can out of visitors. It's how everybody survives. So she's making up some stories now about the farmer. Darling, since when does a Balinese man need to talk to his wife before he can make a business deal? Listen, the guy is desperate to sell her a small parcel. He already said he would. But she wants the whole thing now. And she wants you to buy it for her. I cringe at this for two reasons. First of all, I hate to think this could be true of Wyann. Second, I hate the cultural implications under his speech, the whiff of colonial white man's burden stuff, the patronizing, this is what all these people are like argument. But Felipe isn't a colonialist. He's a Brazilian. He explains, listen, I grew up poor in South America. You think I don't understand the culture of this kind of poverty? You've given Wyann more money than she's ever seen in her life, and now she's thinking crazy. As far as she's concerned, you're her miracle benefactor, and this might be her last chance to ever get a break. So she wants to get all she can before you go. For God's sake, 4 months ago the poor woman didn't have enough money to buy lunch for her child, and now she wants a hotel. What should I do? I ask. Don't get angry about it, whatever happens. If you get angry, you lose her. And that would be a pity, because she's a marvelous person and she loves you. This is her survival tactic, just accept that. You must not think she's not a good person or that she and the kids don't honestly need your help, but you cannot let her take advantage of you. Darling, I've seen it repeated so many times. What happens with Westerners who live here for a long time is that they usually end up falling into one of two camps. Half of them keep playing the tourist, saying, oh, those lovely Balinese, so sweet, so gracious, and getting ripped off like crazy. The other half gets so frustrated with being ripped off all the time, they start to hate the Balinese. And that's a shame, because then you've lost all these wonderful friends. But what should I do? You need to get back some control of the situation. Play some kind of game with her, like the game she's playing with you. Threaten her with something that motivates her to act. You'll be doing her a favor. She needs a home. I don't want to play games, Felipe. He kisses my head. Then you can't live in Bali, darling. The next morning, I hatch my plan. I can't believe it. Here I am, after a year of studying virtues and struggling to find an honest life for myself, about to spin a big, fat lie. I'm about to lie to my favorite person in Bali, to someone who is like a sister to me, someone who has cleaned my kidneys. For heaven's sake, I'm going to lie to Tuti's mommy. I walk into town, into Wyann's shop. Wyann goes to hug me. I pull away, pretending to be upset. Wyann, I say, we need to talk. I have a serious problem. With Felipe? No, with you. She looks like she's going to faint. Wyann, I say, my friends in America are very angry with you. With me? Why, honey? Because 4 months ago they gave you a lot of money to buy a home, and you did not buy a home yet. Every day they send me emails asking me, where is Wyann's house? Where is my money? Now they think you're stealing their money, using it for something else. I'm not stealing. Wyann, I say, my friends in America think you are a bullshit. She gasps as if she's been punched in the windpipe. She looks so wounded, I waver for a moment and almost grab her in a reassuring hug and say, no, no, it's not true, I'm making this up. But no, I have to finish this. But Lord, she is clearly staggered now. Bullshit is a word that has been more emotionally incorporated into Balinese than almost any other in the English language. It's one of the very worst things you can call someone in Bali, a bullshit. In this culture where people bullshit each other a dozen times before breakfast, where bullshitting is a sport, an art, a habit, and a desperate survival tactic, to actually call someone out on their bullshit is an appalling statement. It's something that would have, in old Europe, guaranteed you to a duel. Honey, she said, eyes tearing, I am not a bullshit. I know that, Wyann. That's why I'm so upset. I try to tell my friends in America that Wyann is not a bullshit, but they don't believe me. She lays her hand on mine. I'm sorry to put you in a pickle, honey. Wyann, This is a very big pickle. My friends are angry. They say that you must buy some land before I come back to America. They told me that if you don't buy some land in the next week, then I must take the money back. Now she doesn't look like she's going to faint. She looks like she's going to die. I feel like one half of the biggest prick in history, spinning this tale to this poor woman who, among other things, obviously doesn't realize that I no more have the power to take that money out of her bank account than I have to revoke her Indonesian citizenship. But how could she know that? I made the money magically appear in her bank book, didn't I? Couldn't I just as easily take it away? Honey, she says, believe me, I find land now. Don't worry, very fast I find land. Please, don't worry, maybe in next 3 days this is finished. I promise. You must, Wyann, I say, with a gravity that is not entirely acting. The fact is, she must. Her kids need a home. She's about to get evicted. This is no time to be a bullshit. I say, I'm going back to Felipe's house now. Call me when you've bought something. Then I walk away from my friend, aware that she is watching me, but refusing to turn around and look back at her. All the way home, I'm offering up to God the weirdest prayer. Please let it be true that she's been bullshitting me. Because if she wasn't bullshitting, if she's genuinely incapable of finding herself a place to live despite an $18,000 cash infusion, then we're in really big trouble here, and I don't know how this woman is ever going to pull herself out of poverty. But if she was bullshitting me, then in a way it's a ray of hope. It shows she's got some wiles, and she might be okay in this shifty world after all. I go home to Felipe feeling awful. I say, if only Wyann knew how deviously I was plotting behind her back. Plotting for her happiness and success, he finishes the sentence for me. 4 hours later, four measly hours, the phone rings in Felipe's house. It's Wyann. She's breathless. She wants me to know the job is finished. She has just purchased the 2 RO from the farmer, whose wife suddenly didn't seem to mind breaking up the property. There was no need, as it turns out, for any magic dreams or priestly interventions or Toksu radiation level tests. Wyann even has a certificate of ownership already in her very hands, and it's notarized. Also, she assures me, she has already ordered construction materials for her house and workers will start building early next week before I leave, so that I can see the project underway. She hopes that I am not angry with her. She wants me to know that she loves me more than she loves her own body, more than she loves her own life, more than she loves this whole world. I tell her that I love her too, and that I can't wait to be a guest someday in her beautiful new home. And that I would like a photocopy of that certificate of ownership. When I get off the phone, Felipe says, "Good girl." I don't know whether he's referring to her or to me, but he opens a bottle of wine and we raise a toast to our dear friend, Wyann, the Balinese landowner. Then Felipe says, "Can we go on vacation now, please?" 107. The place we end up going on vacation is a tiny island called Gili Meno, located off the coast of Lombok, which is the next stop east of Bali in the great, sprawling Indonesian archipelago. I'd been to Gili Meno before, and I wanted to show it to Felipe, who had never been there. The island of Gili Meno is one of the most important places in the world to me. I came here by myself 2 years ago, when I was in Bali for the first time. I was on that magazine assignment, writing about yoga vacations, and I just finished 2 weeks of mightily restorative yoga classes. But I had decided to extend my stay in Indonesia after the assignment was up, since I was already all the way over here in Asia. What I wanted to do, actually, was to find some place very remote and give myself a 10-day retreat of absolute solitude and absolute silence. When I look back at the 4 years that elapsed between my marriage starting to fall apart and the day I was finally divorced and free, I see a detailed chronicle of total pain. And the moment when I came to this tiny island all by myself was the very worst of that entire dark journey, the bottom of the pain and the middle of it. My unhappy mind was a battlefield of conflicted demons. As I made my decision to spend 10 days alone and in silence in the middle of exactly nowhere, I told all my warring and confused parts the same thing. We're all here together now, guys, all alone. And we're going to have to work out some kind of deal for how to get along, or else everybody is going to die together sooner or later. Which may sound firm and confident, but I must admit this as well, that sailing over to that quiet island all alone, I was never more terrified in my life. I hadn't even brought any books to read, nothing to distract me, just me and my mind, about to face each other on an empty field. I remembered that my legs were visibly shaking with fear. Then I quoted to myself one of my favorite lines ever from my guru, "Fear? Who cares?" And I disembarked alone. I rented myself a little cabin on the beach for a few dollars a day, and I shut my mouth and vowed not to open it again until something inside me had changed. Gili Meno Island was my ultimate truth and reconciliation hearing. I had chosen the right place to do this, that much was clear. The island itself is tiny, pristine, sandy, blue water, palm trees. It's a perfect circle, with a single path that goes around it, and you can walk the whole circumference in about an hour. It's located almost exactly on the equator, and so there's a changelessness about its daily cycles. The sun comes up on one side of the island at about 6:30 in the morning and goes down on the other side at about 6:30 p.m. every day of the year. The place is inhabited by a small handful of Muslim fishermen and their families. There is no spot on this island from which you cannot hear the ocean. There are no motorized vehicles here. Electricity comes from a generator, and for only a few hours in the evenings. It's the quietest place I've ever been. Every morning, I walked the circumference of the island at sunrise, and walked it again at sunset. The rest of the time, I just sat and watched. Watched my thoughts, watched my emotions, watched the fishermen. The yogic sages say that all the pain of a human life is caused by words, as is all the joy. We create words to define our experience, and those words bring attendant emotions that jerk us around like dogs on a leash. We get seduced by our own mantras, "I'm a failure, I'm lonely, I'm a failure, I'm lonely," and we become monuments to them. To stop talking for a while, then, is an attempt to strip away the power of words, to stop choking ourselves with words, to liberate ourselves from our suffocating mantras. It took me a while to drop into true silence. Even after I'd stopped talking, I found that I was still humming with language. My organs and muscles of speech, brain, throat, chest, back of neck, vibrated with the residual effects of talking long after I'd stopped making sounds. My head shimmied in a reverb of words, the way an indoor swimming pool seems to echo interminably with sounds and shouts even after the kindergartners have left for the day. It took a surprisingly long time for all this pulsation of speech to fall away, for the whirling noises to settle. Maybe it took about 3 days. Then, everything started coming up. In that state of silence, there was room now for everything hateful, everything fearful, to run across my empty mind. I felt like a junkie in detox, convulsing with the poison of what emerged. I cried a lot. I prayed a lot. It was difficult, and it was terrifying, but this much I knew. I never didn't want to be there, and I never wished that anyone were there with me. I knew that I needed to do this, and that I needed to do it alone. The only other tourists on the island were a handful of couples having romantic vacations. Gili Meno is far too pretty and far too remote a place for anyone but a crazy person to come visit solo. I watched these couples, and I felt some envy for their romances, but knew, this is not your time for companionship, Liz. You have a different task here. I kept away from everyone. People on the island left me alone. I think I threw off a spooky vibe. I had not been well all year. You can't lose that much sleep and that much weight and cry so hard for so long without starting to look like a psychotic. So nobody talked to me. Actually, that's not true. One person talked to me every day. It was this little kid, one of a gang of kids who run up and down the beaches trying to sell fresh fruit to the tourists. This boy was maybe 9 years old and seemed to be the ringleader. He was tough, scrappy, and I would have called him street smart if his island actually had any streets. He was beach smart, I suppose. Somehow he'd learned great English, probably from harassing sunbathing Westerners. And he was on to me, this kid. Nobody else asked me who I was, nobody else bothered me, but this relentless child would come and sit next to me on the beach at some point every day and demand, "Why don't you ever talk? Why are you strange like this? Don't pretend you can't hear me. I know you can hear me. Why are you always alone? Why don't you ever go swimming? Where's your boyfriend? Why don't you have a husband? What's wrong with you?" I was like, "Back off, kid. What are you, a transcript of my most evil thoughts?" Every day, I would try to smile at him kindly and send him away with a polite gesture, but he wouldn't quit until he got a rise out of me. And inevitably, he always got a rise out of me. I remember bursting out at him once, "I'm not talking because I'm on a friggin' spiritual journey, you nasty little punk. Now go away." He ran away laughing. Every day after he'd gotten me to respond, he would always run away laughing. I'd usually end up laughing too once he was out of sight. I dreaded this pesky kid and looked forward to him in equal measure. He was my only comedic break during a really tough ride. St. Anthony once wrote about having gone into the desert on silent retreat and being assaulted by all manner of visions, devils and angels both. He said, in his solitude, he sometimes encountered devils who looked like angels, and other times he found angels who looked like devils. When asked how he could tell the difference, the saint said that you can only tell which is which by the way you feel after the creature has left your company. If you are appalled, he said, then it was a devil who had visited you. If you feel lightened, it was an angel. I think I know what that little punk was, who always got a laugh out of me. On my 9th day of silence, I went into meditation one evening on the beach as the sun was going down, and I didn't stand up again until after midnight. I remember thinking, "This is it, Liz." I said to my mind, "This is your chance. Show me everything that is causing you sorrow. Let me see all of it. Don't hold anything back." One by one, the thoughts and memories of sadness raised their hands, stood up to identify themselves. I looked at each thought, at each unit of sorrow, and I acknowledged its existence and felt, without trying to protect myself from it, its horrible pain. And then I would tell that sorrow, "It's okay. I love you. I accept you. Come into my heart now. It's over." I would actually feel the sorrow as if it were a living thing, enter my heart as if it were an actual room. Then I would say, "Next?" And the next bit of grief would surface. I would regard it, experience it, bless it, and invite it into my heart too. I did this with every sorrowful thought I'd ever had, reaching back into years of memory until nothing was left. Then I said to my mind, "Show me your anger now." One by one, my life's every incident of anger rose and made itself known. Every injustice, every betrayal, every loss, every rage. I saw them all, one by one, and I acknowledged their existence. I felt each piece of anger completely, as if it were happening for the first time, and then I would say, "Come into my heart now. You can rest there. It's safe now. It's over. I love you." This went on for hours, and I swung between these mighty poles of opposite feelings, experiencing the anger thoroughly for one bone-rattling moment, and then experiencing a total coolness as the anger entered my heart as if through a door, laid itself down, curled up against its brothers, and gave up fighting. Then came the most difficult part. "Show me your shame," I asked my mind. Dear God, the horrors that I saw then, a pitiful parade of all my failings, my lies, my selfishness, jealousy, arrogance. I didn't blink from any of it, though. "Show me your worst," I said. When I tried to invite these units of shame into my heart, they each hesitated at the door, saying, "No, you don't want me in there. Don't you know what I did?" And I would say, "I do want you. Even you, I do. Even you are welcome here. It's okay. You are forgiven. You are part of me. You can rest now. It's over." When all this was finished, I was empty. Nothing was fighting in my mind anymore. I looked into my heart at my own goodness, and I saw its capacity. I saw that my heart was not even nearly full, not even after having taken in and tended to all those calamitous urchins of sorrow and anger and shame. My heart could have easily received and forgiven even more. Its love was infinite. I knew then that this is how God loves us all and receives us all, and that there is no such thing in this universe as hell, except maybe in our own terrified minds. Because if even one broken and limited human being could experience even one such episode of absolute forgiveness and acceptance of her own self, then imagine, just imagine, what God, in all his eternal compassion, can forgive and accept. I also knew somehow that this respite of peace would be temporary. I knew that I was not yet finished for good, that my anger, my sadness, and my shame would all creep back eventually, escaping my heart and occupying my head once more. I knew that I would have to keep dealing with these thoughts again and again until slowly and determinedly I changed my whole life, and that this would be difficult and exhausting to do. But my heart said to my mind, in the dark silence of that beach, "I love you, I will never leave you, I will always take care of you." That promise floated up out of my heart, and I caught it in my mouth and held it there, tasting it as I left the beach and walked back to the little shack where I was staying. I found an empty notebook, opened it up to the first page, and only then did I open my mouth and speak those words into the air, letting them free. I let those words break my silence, and then I allowed my pencil to document their colossal statement onto the page. "I love you. I will never leave you. I will always take care of you." Those were the first words I ever wrote in that private notebook of mine, which I would carry with me from that moment forth, turning back to it many times over the next 2 years, always asking for help and always finding it, even when I was most deadly afraid or sad. And that notebook, steeped through with that promise of love, was quite simply the only reason I survived the next years of my life. 108. And now I'm coming back to Gillymeno under notably different circumstances. Since I was last here, I've circled the world, settled my divorce, survived my final separation from David, erased all mood-altering medications from my system, learned to speak a new language, sat upon God's palm for a few unforgettable moments in India, studied at the feet of an Indonesian medicine man, and purchased a home for a family who sorely needed a place to live. I am happy and healthy and balanced. And yes, I cannot help but notice that I am sailing to this pretty little tropical island with my Brazilian lover, which is, I admit it, an almost ludicrously fairy tale ending to this story, like the page out of some housewife's dream, perhaps even a page out of my own dream from years ago. Yet what keeps me from dissolving right now into a complete fairy tale shimmer is this solid truth, a truth which has veritably built my bones over the last few years. I was not rescued by a prince. I was the administrator of my own rescue. My thoughts turn to something I read once, something the Zen Buddhists believe. They say that an oak tree is brought into creation by two forces at the same time. Obviously, there is the acorn from which it all begins, the seed which holds all the promise and potential which grows into the tree. Everybody can see that. But only a few can recognize that there is another force operating here as well, the future tree itself, which wants so badly to exist that it pulls the acorn into being, drawing the seedling forth with longing out of the void, guiding the evolution from nothingness to maturity. In this respect, say the Zens, it is the oak tree that creates the very acorn from which it was born. I think about the woman I have become lately, about the life that I am now living, and about how much I always wanted to be this person and live this life, liberated from the farce of pretending to be anyone other than myself. I think of everything I endured before getting here, and I wonder if it was me. I mean, This happy and balanced me, who was now dozing on the deck of this small Indonesian fishing boat, who pulled the younger, more confused, and more struggling me forward during all those hard years. The younger me was the acorn full of potential, but it was the older me, the already existent oak, who was saying the whole time, yes, grow, change, evolve, come and meet me here, where I already exist in wholeness and maturity. I need you to grow into me. And maybe it was this present and fully actualized me who was hovering 4 years ago over that young, married, sobbing girl on the bathroom floor, and maybe it was this me who whispered lovingly into that desperate girl's ear, go back to bed, Liz. Knowing already that everything would be okay, that everything would eventually bring us together here, right to this moment, where I was always waiting in peace and contentment, always waiting for her to arrive and join me. Then Felipe wakes up. We'd both been dozing in and out of consciousness all afternoon, curled in each other's arms on the deck of this Indonesian fisherman's sailboat. The ocean has been swaying us, the sun shining. While I lie there with my head pillowed on his chest, Felipe tells me that he had an idea while he was sleeping. He says, you know, I obviously need to keep living in Bali because my business is here and because it's so close to Australia where my kids live. I also need to be in Brazil often because that's where the gemstones are and because I have family there. And you obviously need to be in the United States because that's where your work is and that's where your family and friends are. So I was thinking, maybe we could try to build a life together that's somehow divided between America, Australia, Brazil, and Bali. All I can do is laugh because, hey, why not? It just might be crazy enough to work. A life like this might strike some people as absolutely loony, as sheer foolishness, but it resembles me so closely. Of course this is how we should proceed. It feels so familiar already. And I quite like the poetry of his idea, too, I must say. I mean that literally. After this whole year spent exploring the individual and intrepid eyes, Felipe has just suggested to me a whole new theory of traveling. Australia, America, Bali, Brazil equals AABB. Like a classic poem, like a pair of rhyming couplets. The little fishing boat anchors right off the shore of Gili Meno. There are no docks here on this island. You have to roll up your pants, jump off the boat, and wade in through the surf on your own power. There's absolutely no way to do this without getting soaking wet or even banged up on the coral, but it's worth all the trouble because the beach here is so beautiful, so special. So me and my lover, we take off our shoes, we pile our small bags of belongings on the tops of our heads, and we prepare to leap over the edge of that boat together into the sea. You know, it's a funny thing. The only romance language Felipe doesn't happen to speak is Italian. But I go ahead and say it to him anyway, just as we're about to jump. I say, attraversiamo. Let's cross over. This is Elizabeth Gilbert. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Eat, Pray, Love. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse, produced by Dan Musselman, engineered by Nikki Banks, and directed by Scott Creswell. Eat, Pray, Love is a production of Penguin Audio, a division of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape. Copyright 2006, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.